I'm Marilyn Slater, and I'm an alcoholic. And I feel like I'm in the North Woods, and it feels good. Really grateful to Tim for the privilege of standing here and speaking at my home group. And very thankful to Tim. When I was secretary at this meeting, Tim was a great help to me. He helped me organize all the commitments and then took a major commitment and had so much integrity, and I know this is going to be an excellent year, and we're very lucky to have Tim. First time I spoke at this meeting was over 26 years ago, and I was 30 days sober. And in the old days, the oldest old-timers were something like 10 years sober, or I think Clancy was 14 or 15. And Byron was standing in for Tommy C. And I just said, I can't do it. I can't. And I ran to my sponsor, Marion, and she said, that's an AA request. Of course you can do it. And when I said, I'll do anything, Marion, I didn't cover things like that. So she said, do it. And I got up to the podium. And this group was smaller, 200, 300 people in those days. And it met on Tuesday nights. And I talked, and I was terrified. And I told the group all about my neurotic childhood. And then my neurotic adulthood. And my compulsive overeating. And gasped and sat down. And everybody clapped because, really, you can't do anything wrong at the AA podium. And Marion was so kind. She said, that was wonderful, Marilyn. You got up and you talked. And now you have to learn to mention your drinking. And much of these 26 years have been, this adventure has taught me about my drinking, taught me that I am an alcoholic. I loved our first two 10-minute speakers because they told my story, as every alcoholic does, if they talk about their drinking. And that identification was a very slow process for me. I came into the program not really convinced that I was an alcoholic. I was certainly desperate and was drinking myself to death, but it took a long time to learn that. It took a long time for me to understand that the pattern of my life was very like the pattern of every life I've heard. And for a long time, I almost passed for normal. I was an Ohio girl, and kind of looked like other Ohio girls. Went off to the big university in Chicago and studied science. And I had a lot of if-onlys. If only I could win the Nobel Prize, I'd be a happy person. If only I could meet a scientist, I'd be a happy person. And some of those if-onlys started coming true. And I did meet a scientist. He had a white lab coat and a slide rule in his pocket. If you're young, I must tell you, a slide rule is an old-fashioned calculator. I looked at it, and I wanted to fondle his slide rule. We had all kinds of things in common, like Schrodinger's equation and the hypergeometric function. And it was not long before we were married on the basis of things like that. And after a few weeks, it got tense because, we began to argue about the nature of gravitational force. And but still, I kind of looked like a normal person. Young Ohio girl goes off to the University of Chicago and marries a scientist and studies science, and they move to California, and Bill, the scientist, got a job and was a scientist here, and Marilyn now was looking like a scientist, had her own lab coat and her own slide rule. And the difference was, I think, between me and them was that I just felt crazy all the time. I felt out of place in Ohio and got to Chicago and felt out of place there. And felt out of place in Los Angeles, felt out of place in the lab. Just always imagined that they knew how to do it, talk to one another. And they seemed to have friends. They could mingle together in groups. Whenever I tried to mingle together in a group, somebody hurt my feelings and made me embarrassed. And by saying something to me like, hi, or they expected answers. And I would have maybe passed if I hadn't tried to give answers, but God forbid somebody should say, how are you? Because I would tell them. And people out in the real world are not that interested in my deep neuroses. So life was strange. On the outside, it kind of looked normal. On the inside, it felt very strange. And yet around this time, something amazing and wonderful happened. Seemed wonderful at the time. And the miracle for me occurred in Shakey's Pizza Parlor, this great mecca of something or other. Seemed like spirituality, but it was spirits. They brought beer to me in Shakey's. Now, it took a long time for me to have the answer, which was the minor answer. The major answer, of course, is Alcoholics Anonymous, but the minor answer was alcohol. It did not seem like an answer until beer came into my life. I guess it was so dilute I could drink it really fast and get to that place that I'd longed to be all of my life, that place of peace of mind, that place where I could just sit down and talk to other people and feel relaxed, just feel like I was one with the human race. I could feel like a real scientist then. I mean, the Nobel Prize just seemed right around the corner, so close, after 3 or 4 big mugs of beer. Now, I had drunk alcohol. In fact, every time I encountered alcohol, it was like a big cold fusion reaction. I mean, it was spectacular. And the first time, when I was about 12 or 13 years old, I'd gone to a party with my mom. She worked for the Air Force, and she had taken me along, and I saw these mixed drinks, and some of them were standing around without people attached to them, and I drank them all after one. And then I was kind of lost a little bit of the memory tape, and I kind of came to, and I was out in the bushes making out with my mother's boss, a colonel in the Air Force. And he was groping and patting, and I was saying, this is the happiest moment of my life. My life of all of 12 years. And then, mercifully, I faded into another blackout, and as I came out of it, I was back in the officers' club. This time I was pawing and groping the colonel, and his wife was sitting ever closer to him, staring at me in a strange kind of way, and he was acting like he had never, ever seen me. And I was sad. And then, merciful, there was another blackout. And the next thing I knew was my mother lamenting her friends in the officers' club getting her sweet little daughter drunk and how sad that was. And then ran into things like gimlets and Manhattans a little later at parties with my husband when he was struggling to be a scientist and please his new department. I'd go to parties and work against that desire. So I didn't have an answer until beer came into my life, and that became a way of life for me as long as I could push it. It's funny that my life up to that point, as I said, could have passed for normal. I got married and had a job in a lab and was not doing well. Every time I did experiments in the lab, I broke a lot of glassware and things blew up. And I was losing patience. They were losing patience, was more like it. But I just felt that I need a drink. And it just became very comforting to have it in the lab. Had to do all of my work in a refrigerator after I discovered beer, though, so that I could drink beer all day and all evening, spend 18 hours in a cold room there with a heavy parka on. But it's a small price to pay to be near beer all the time. After about 3 years, the director of the lab asked me what I'd been doing in that cold room, and I could not remember. So that seemed to be the end of my career in science. And the years that followed were a little bit gray. I moved home to be sad, really. I had drunk my way out of my only hope, which was science. And now I was sitting on my couch thinking about things and getting more and more paranoid. My husband came home at night and said things like, "Now that you don't work anymore, why don't you make a dinner for us now and then?" And I couldn't handle that kind of stress. So it was time for a geographic, and I got to my garage. And sat down and did not feel like moving for quite a few years. However, I must have moved around a little bit because our children were born in these years. And I'd go in to see them and try to take care of their needs and count them, first of all. And I was losing it, and everybody knew it, and I needed custodial care, and that came in the form of grandmothers, my mother-in-law, my mother, and they kind of alternated and kind of took care of things, did for me what I couldn't do for myself, and I was ashamed and miserable and dying, and that was over 26 years ago, and that was the shameful female alcoholic. Nobody really knew what to do, And yet there was a part of me that liked it because I have a parasitic nature. I've always found that that was the easier, softer way. Not do anything and expect somebody to take care of me. And most of the people that I met, especially of the male variety, would run in terror because they could sense the circular mouth with teeth that was homing in to attach and suck. And they wanted to keep their essence and move on. And, and yet, somehow I fooled Bill. I talked about Gegenbauer polynomials until it was too late. And he's a man of honor. And it didn't take long for me to attach like a tick. And and I don't know why he stayed with me, but it was just a series of things like hold ankles tightly and say, "You don't really love me, do you? You don't. I know you don't. That's why I'm so miserable." And finally, I'd be so miserable that I'd just punish him with silence for maybe 2 or 3 years at a time. And so this was our life. And I don't know why I tried Alcoholics Anonymous. It could have been the gentle urging of my mother-in-law, unless you stop drinking and get control of your life, we're going to see that you get locked up and you'll never see the children again. And I just thought, boy, she has her nerve. Talking to me like that, right here in my own garage. But something... I heard something, kind of felt like a cold hand around my heart, and I began to make trips into Alcoholics Anonymous. I came first in 1969, but it was hard for me to get the message. It was not until 1972, February 8, 1972, which I hope is my one and only sobriety date for all time. And by that time, I was not only desperate, but I was willing. And I was at a meeting and I heard my story. Marion was talking and she talked about fear, the kind of fear I had. She talked about holding her husband by the ankles. And I thought, yes, I recognize that one. And yet she didn't look like a person that acted that way. And she was happy. In fact, she was more than happy. She was joyful. And I said, "Would you be my sponsor?" And she said she would if I would do what she suggested. And I said, "Anything." And I had no idea what that anything meant. But I was willing. And my willingness dragged me through the door. And I was set down right in the middle of the Pacific group, which saved my life because it's a custodial care kind of group. And I needed it. I mean, the Pacific group can occupy 24 hours a day if you need it. And I was signed up into 7 meetings a week. And I said, I can't do that. Marion said, I'll help you find a babysitter. And that began the adventure. I didn't bargain on the steps. I thought maybe somehow this group, in those days too, it talked about activity. And that was saving me. I came into the group and I was afraid of everybody, but I moved into the herd. And there has been one thing that has stood me in good stead. It sounds horrible, and yet it is a deep and hideous need for your approval. And it drove me to do things I never would have done. I wanted Marianne's approval. I wanted everybody's approval. And so I just tried to keep up with the herd. And before long, I actually brought on the wrath of Clancy. I was just trying to make myself out to be just a little cleverer than other people because I thought, if you could see, there's Marilyn Slater. She was once a scientist, and maybe she's clever. I'd like to be her friend. And Clancy just said something like, Marilyn, why don't you try to act like other alcoholics? You like group noise too much. You're looking for too much approval. Why don't you just join the ranks? You'll have a terminal case of making yourself different and you'll die drunk. And I just thought, the nerve of Clancy. How can he talk to me like that? And I've said that to many newcomers, many, many, many newcomers. And it was exactly what I needed to hear. And yet that night, it didn't sound too good because it amounted to public humiliation for me. And I knew I would go home and kill myself. Luckily, I'd become sort of acquainted with a newcomer named Beverly, and she said, call me when you get home. And I called her, and we talked about suicide, and she said, I just don't think that's an option. You probably just wake up on the other side with the same rotten attitude. I said, okay. And we had known that drinking is not an option. Suicide, maybe, but she said no. And then we figured out that the only other alternative is to keep on trudging. I mean, there's only 3 options. Suicide, drink yourself to death, or keep on trudging. It's kind of like the Big Book talks about accepting this way of life, which amounts to a spiritual solution, or dying drunk, accepting an alcoholic death. And it's hard to make that decision in the beginning. Both of them sound so very hard. And keep on trudging to me sounded like gray life forever, being imprisoned by Alcoholics Anonymous, minding harsh sponsors who tell you to do things you don't want to do that scare you to death, and a life of gray service. And it was, it certainly was boot camp. The Pacific Group was boot camp for me. It brought me into the steps, and I remember writing, actually had to write 3 inventories before I got to some basic character defects. You laugh, but I am very slow at facing my own character defects. Marion told me that she and Byron were moving away before I was a year sober, and I said, don't go. I can't stay sober. She said, I gotta go. And I grabbed her ankles and tried to hold her here. Said, there'll never be another Marion, and there wasn't. And that's because I had attached tick-like to Marion. And that was all right in the beginning, but Marion gently said, you need a sponsor in your home group because you're pretty intense. And and what happened was that the tick just got lifted off, and I kind of transferred some of that dependency to Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. And I have had sponsors since, but it was a different kind of a relationship, where I was not hanging on to the ankles quite so much, but listening and trying to understand, experience strength and hope from them. And by that time, I was at step 6 and 7, and that was pretty scary because I was saying, God, take all of me, good and bad, and I'm willing that you take away every defect of character that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows, and grant me strength to go out from here. the seventh step, and do your bidding. I was kind of giving it all over to God, a God that I wasn't quite sure of. Way back in Ohio, I had kind of tested the notion of God, and God failed my test, actually. And years of science had kind of confirmed that there is nothing but the beautiful laws of physics, chemistry, and biology, and that can explain it all. You can see that the creation of life can be explained by the second law of thermodynamics. And that's what I brought into the program, trying to interpret the third step, the seventh step, with stuff like that. And back in Ohio, I was a small child around the time of groping with the colonel. My father was involved in a hideous auto accident, and he was left in a coma. And I prayed to this Ohio God, if you're there, give me a sign, and if you're really there, heal my dad, make him well. And I'd heard about God, even though I came from a long line of atheists. God can open big bodies of water, and soldiers can walk through the water, and God can lift people up from the dead. God can do big things, and it's not too much to ask, I said to God, for you to make my dad well. He's still alive. Just make him well. Allow him to take up his bed and walk. And I went to the hospital day after day, week after week, with my mom, year after year. He finally died after about 12 years, just a tiny little shriveled up thing. And my hope that there was a God died with that. So I brought that into the program, worshiping the great God, no God. And a lot of the steps had God in them, but I was told, just give lip service to it and take the steps to the best of your ability. But get on your knees and ask God for sobriety in the morning. Thank God for your sobriety at the end of the day and pray for the alcoholic who still suffers. Then add some prayers, prayers of thanks, if you can see anything good happening in your life. I just faced the sixth and seventh step thinking, I don't know what this means. I mean, I can say this prayer, but there's only two little paragraphs in the big book. An old-timer said, there's not much written about it because God does all the work in that step. You're giving it all over to God to make you into something that can be of service to God, not to. If this is not a self-improvement program, it's not a success in your business program. It's a program that makes us useful to God and to others. And I was saying that prayer long before it made any sense to me. And God was doing the work in the sixth and seventh step. But working through this big group, because there are so many egos here, so many people, that there is a tremendous sanding down process, sanding away character defects. I had run into this in Ohio. I mean, kids playing out in the snow. And I always felt hurt by anything that other kids did because I thought that they picked on me and called me horrible names. I chipped a tooth as a kid, and they called me Old Snaggle Tooth. And I just thought, I'll never, ever talk to them again. And I just went through life saying to one person after another, I'll never talk to them again. They never noticed, but I just crossed people off my list one by one by one by one by one. And so I ran from that. I'd always hide in my room and grow strange things under my bed and read science books. And other kids, and I don't know how kids know this, but they would hang in and they would get tough by that. They would be sanded down. They would become people that could go out and live and function and be productive citizens. And I missed that because I hid from it. But in the Pacific group, Beverly and I had concluded, you can kill yourself, you can die drunk, or you can keep on trudging. And keep on trudging means get super involved. Go to lots of meetings. Take the steps. Rub egos with other people. And I just found that it was dreadful and painful. I didn't experience much joy for a long time. Probably about 3 years it took for me before I could laugh. I began to come to the other side. I had to cross an invisible line in sobriety. And that invisible line for me was coming across that line to the acceptance that I am an alcoholic just like other alcoholics. And it took about 3 years before I really entered in. And around that time, too, I had made amends to the director of the lab. I said, I am really sorry to my husband and to my kids, to my mother-in-law, to my mother, to a lot of people that I had burned. I had said, what can I do to kind of undo some of this harm I've caused? For me, most of my amends have been living amends. And as I was well into the amends step, promises began to come true. I found great authenticity in the big book, strangely enough. And what was astounding for me, that before I was halfway through the amends step, the veil parted and I came into contact with a God of my very own. And it was not a big deal, but it was a big deal. It was an experience of, oh, yes, you've been there all along. And I could see, yes, indeed, that God had been in my life all along. Marion being the speaker that night at my first meeting, being brought into the Pacific Group, probably the only group strong enough to draw me out of the garage and save my life. I began to see the hand of God everywhere, and that certainly changed my life. Not too long after that, we moved to San Francisco, and I thought that Alcoholics Anonymous would be a life of gray service. And instead, what was happening was that I was being drawn into life in a strange way. I was getting acquainted with my husband and my family just by trying to make amends to them, just following direction. I remember one time in the beginning of trying to talk with Bill. After I got sober, I'd try old and tested remedies, which was, do you love me? And I didn't get a satisfactory answer. And I called Marion and told her that we'd been talking about our relationship, and she said, I told you not to do that. Go to lots of meetings, and now why don't you go back and just ask him what he'd like for dinner? Sweetie, say that. What would you like for dinner, sweetie? And I'll tell you, it was like learning a foreign language for me. But that was a beginning, because when I said that to Bill, what would you like for dinner, sweetie? He had an answer. He just said, pizza. And that began something new. We began to get acquainted. And I got to know my kids, too. Rather than working directly on being a mom and going to mommy classes and studying out of books, I think the thing that helped me be a mom was talking with people in Alcoholics Anonymous, especially newcomers. And then when I had the privilege of sponsoring people, that allowed me to turn the corner, because I was so intense about being a sponsor at first. They had to do it right or I would be a failure. And that's how I felt about being a mom after I got sober. And by the way, I could count them. There were three of them. I thought there were more when I was drinking. But Becky, David, Susie, there were three. And by being a sponsor, one of my first babies was a person named Irma. And Beverly remembers her, I'm sure. And gosh, she was doing well. She was coming up on a year. I mean, she was 11 months sober. And I answered the phone for her morning call, and I was so happy, and Irma was doing so well. And I said, hi, Irma, how's it going? And she was crying. And I thought, I better put on the sponsor suit and really have an answer for her to fix up her life one more time. And she said, I got drunk last night. Irma, how could you do this to me? I mean, I was going to give you a cake. I mean, oh, the pain of my baby that disappointed me. And it was even worse. I went back and I talked with my sponsor, and I was told, you're going to have to release her now. You gave her your best shot, and it would be a disservice to try to sponsor her. And that has been my strong belief, that if I sponsor somebody and that person is not able to stay sober, I must let that person go to move on to somebody else who might have answers. That's, I'm convinced, the only bad thing, the only wrong thing we can do in Alcoholics Anonymous, because that kind of takes us back to ground zero. Everything else, robbing a bank, everything else causes terrible pain in the long run. And we learn something from that. If we finally work through it, we have something tremendous to share with others. So there is no such thing as failing in Alcoholics Anonymous as long as we stay sober, because I'm convinced we learn something from every action that we take. We take a good action, we don't learn too much. We take a bad action, we get into deep and hideous pain and generally learn something. And it's a shame that it has to be that way. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could learn from the experience of others? I've often thought that. But I have sought out my own pain many times and do so to this day. Just, guess it's the scientist nature coming out in me. Speaking of scientist nature, a strange thing happened. I made amends to that director of the lab, and he called me up one day and said, "Would you like to come back to work?" Now, it was a strange thing that he just happened to call at a time that we would be moving back from San Francisco. And the kids were in school, and I was not feeling quite so much guilt about them by making living amends and kind of growing up with them. The guilt was going away, and it was possible that I could go back to work. And I said, yes, yes, I would do that. And then something came to mind. I wanted so to work when I was new. I wanted to go back because I felt a lot of shame about drinking my way out of the lab. Everybody told me, when the time is right, there'll be a knock at the door. But go to work in Alcoholics Anonymous. Learn how to make coffee. Learn how to set up chairs. That's work. Learn how to do that. And then maybe someday you'll go to work in the real world. And I did that. And then I was able to go back to work in the lab when the time was right, just as they said. Strange thing happened when I went back to work in that lab. I started doing research again. And much to my great chagrin, I broke a lot of glassware and things blew up. I caused these explosions. And I thought, how can this be? I'm sober. And because I was sober, I could kind of learn from experience. I liked writing grant proposals and organizing information. And my friends in the lab said, and I had friends in the lab, strangely enough. They no longer seem strange because I had learned a language in Alcoholics Anonymous that seemed to let me enter into these other groups in the real world. Rather than this strange life of service in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was being drawn out into the real world. And they said, there's a whole school. It's called the School of Library and Information Science. Why don't you apply? And I applied to that school, and they deal with information big time. And I loved it. And I never would have noticed that had it not been the fact that I had been sober and learned to follow those strange opportunities that come up that God seems to know are best for me. I don't know what they are, but I find them if I take direction and live the AA life. I am just led into these things I would never, ever have discovered. Years went by and I got acquainted with my husband and worked and went back to school and life was good. And several years ago, when I was about 18 years sober, I was kind of becoming a spectator in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I kind of thought, boy, I've been around here for a long time. I can just sit here, let other people participate. I never held up my hand at meetings. I was going to a lot of quiet meetings, and that was fun. I got my foundation in the Pacific Group and moved on, as many people do, and it stood me in good stead. But I made a trip to Israel because my young daughter, Susie, had gone there to live on a kibbutz for 6 months, and so I joined her. And I don't know what Israel has to do with it. I think the time was right in my sobriety. The kids were up and out of the house, and sobriety had been kind to me. I had entered the real world, and my family was whole. And there was a restlessness, and it grew very intense in Israel. I think maybe God had something to do it because God often does things in Israel, if you think about it. I felt so intense that I wanted to come back here and I wanted to do something beautiful for God. I was just really excited. And I talked with people. And I said, is it Mother Teresa? Is it time to go to Calcutta? And they said, I don't think so. I mean, you have a husband here. I mean, you're an alcoholic. This is your home group. It's giving you... I mean, it's ridiculous. You're not even Catholic. Well, but I thought, it's got to be something like Mother Teresa. I just felt I want to work with the poorest of the poor. And I just want to live a life of service, and I want Mother Teresa. And God was telling me something, and I was just mixing the message. When I listen to God directly, I often get it confused. Other people were saying, no, it's not Calcutta. what it was saying. I'm convinced this is the message, but it was just getting garbled on the way from the ether. And it was, it's not Calcutta, it's Venice, California. It's 1212 Lake Street. It's not Mother Teresa, it's Clancy. It's not the poorest of the poor, it's the sickest of the sick newcomers. Okay, I get it. I mean, I didn't understand because I was in the middle of it. It's like the fish in the ocean. Where's the water? I was already in it. But with deep longing, I came back to the Pacific Group because that was the only thing that could satisfy this hunger to pay back Alcoholics Anonymous, what it had given me so abundantly. And my life, I thought, I'll come back and it will be just like Mother Teresa. I'll get a sari and I'll take a vow of poverty and just live a life of service, cleaning the backyard and ministering to newcomers in a serious way. I had no idea what was in store. Alcoholics Anonymous became more fun than it's ever been in my life. I've always loved Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was so much fun. Clancy suggested when he became my sponsor that I go to the Wednesday night meeting. But instead, I went to 7 meetings a week and all the watches and went to the yard. And I loved every minute of it. I couldn't stop. And it was feeding that deep longing, that longing that only Alcoholics Anonymous can feed. I had extra energy because the kids were up and out. And this place always has a place to put extra energy. Instead of this life of service in AA, which probably is a life of service in AA, I was asked to teach at one of the universities around here in my profession. I enjoy that tremendously. I am taking a watercolor course because I like that kind of thing. My life has filled up with many things that I never expected to have. And it's all because of you. Thank you.